Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X-Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X-Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. And greetings, Earth Explorers. It's good to be back. Hope you all had a good holiday. And we hope you have a safe and happy new year as well. The solar wind tonight is 321.3 kilometers per second and still no sunspots. Actually, the solar wind hasn't changed much in about 3 weeks. If you were looking up through the light clouds at the full moon this month, you may have even seen a moon bow. It is known as the Peregrine moon. It's very large, largest of the year, brightest of the year. And good news is January, the first full moon of January, will be the brightest of the year. If you want to do some moon bathing, that will be the moon from which you will get the deepest tan.
And the red
ones on December 26th, the Messenger spacecraft will have traveled 3 billion miles since its launch, marking somewhat more than 60% of the probe's journey toward its destination to be inserted into the orbit around Mercury. We should learn a lot from that probe. Standing in the Himalayan valley of Langtang, Rinjin Dorje Lama remembers where he used to play as a child in the 1960s. He says, when I was a kid, it was a lot longer, talking about the Lyrung Glacier surrounded by snowy peaks called the northern border of Tibet. We used to play on the glacier, and it came right down to the monastery, but now it's about 2 kilometers further back. I myself have been to that glacier. I've looked at it, and it has retreated. Well over a mile from its original location. Temperatures in the Himalayas are rising by about 0.06 of a degree Celsius. That's about 0.1 of a degree Fahrenheit annually, according to a long-term study by the Nepalese Department of Hydrology. The rate is far above the global average given last year by the UN's senior scientists, who said surface temperatures have risen by a total, and get this, 0.74 degrees C over the past 100 years. Quite interesting about the about global warming and how people feel about it. It is just still an arm wrestling match in the scientific community. Looking back over columns from the Daily Telegraph in the last 12 months, the first, on May 21st, headed Climate Change Threat to Alpine Ski Resorts, reported that the entire Alpine winter sports industry could soon grind to a halt for lack of snow. The second, on December 19th, just 7 months later, headed The Alps Have Best Snow Conditions in a Generation, reported that this winter's Alpine snowfalls look to set to beat all records by New Year's Day. And here we are again in the winter of 2008, and again we are having tremendous snow and record cold temperatures all across the country and even in the southern hemisphere. So there is an arm wrestling match going on about global warming. We, of course, here at X Squared Radio will keep you posted on the latest progress with respect to that controversy. Last week on X Squared Radio, we had an archive with Don Miguel Ruiz, Dr. Richard Bartlett, and Maureen St. Germain. If you missed it, we'll have it posted this weekend for you, and that way you can listen to it while you're working on your favorite project. We do want to let you know tonight we have all phone lines open, so if you want to reach us on the toll-free number U.S. and Canada, it is 888-228-4494. Canada, we also have a special toll-free number for you, 877-489-6350. Anywhere else, on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-776-5154 or 5185. And if you're using Skype, we didn't leave you out, you can reach us at BBS Radio. And if you're using PalTalk, you can reach us at bbsradio_com. The interesting thing about this program is occasionally we get to meet some truly remarkable phenomenons. And, you know, we read a lot of books. We talk to a lot of scientists. We get into a lot of hard data. That's why you tune into this program, because we try to stay out there on the very edge of science and technology and try to bring you and ask the questions that you would ask on a level that that is meaningful. This week, we have a very special guest. She and I talked today, and I immediately saw the value in having her on the program for you. If you ever saw the movie Phenomenon with John Travolta, you know about the ability of some people to hear the oncoming tones of an earthquake and be able to predict earthquakes and even volcanic eruptions by doing that. Well, our guest tonight has that ability and more. The ability has been proven and documented so well, it is named after her. Please welcome with me Charlotte King. How are you, Charlotte?
I'm fine, thank you.
Well, I can't tell you what an, you know, everything on this program is unexpected. And that's what we like about it, because it's fresh, it's unscripted, and we really, try to go just a little bit beyond people's imaginations. And that's why they tune in, because this isn't really a broadcast program. It's a scientific, discussion, a dialogue. Mm-hmm. And it goes well beyond the canned stuff that you hear on History Channel or Discovery Channel. We really get into the meat of things and try to understand how things work, and it's inspirational to people. People mm-hmm. like it, and that's why we're here. Now, some experts say that earthquakes cannot reliably be predicted, but there are some precursors to them that are common. And one that I learned about recently is that the ionosphere issues a disturbance in its normal frequency, from its normal frequency, that may be in the ELF range. That's very peculiar, because most humans cannot hear that frequency. Can you tell us a little bit about how this first occurred to you, how you realized that you could hear frequencies that low?
Well, actually, it occurred quite by accident. I was sitting in my home in 1976 in May reading a book, and all of a sudden I began hearing what I thought were foghorns, which was very strange since it was the middle of May. It was very warm, and we were about a mile and a half from the river, but that river never has any boats on it that use foghorns. And instinctively, I got up and looked toward the river, but the view was blocked by trees and a hill. And they just were continuous foghorns, and those sounds have never left since that time, although I hear 13 distinctive tones, or signatures, as I call them, that go with different geographical locations. And as of today, I have a new sound, which I'm not quite sure what it means yet. It's a series of four tones, a small break, and a series of four tones again. And I mentioned that to you, I believe, earlier today, that I had a new sound that has just started. I won't know what it means for at least 72 hours. And
wow, so
then if something happens...
It's like a repetitive pattern of tones that comes to you over and over again.
Yes, a repetitive pattern, a signature, uh-huh. And
wow.
If something happens out of the ordinary in 4 days, 3 to 4 days, then I will wait, and if I hear that sound again, I will log that sound and see if that same area is affected. And after that happens 3 or 4 times, then I will log it as an actual precursor sound to my sounds that I hear.
Now, this is a sound you've never heard before, a pattern you've never heard before.
A pattern I've never heard before, that's true. Uh-huh.
Well, hopefully, let me ask you your feelings on it. Do you think that this is an introduction to a different kind of cataclysm than you've predicted?
No, I think it's probably another earthquake or even a volcanic event, but it's a different location because the sound signature is different. Like I have single tones that are long and single tones that are short that go with various parts of the world. And then I have a single tone that goes to a dual tone that goes back to a single tone, which is Washington, Canada, Alaska, Aleutians, Japan. But this one is just four tones repeatedly over and over again. So it's got a very distinct pattern.
So the next major earthquake that occurs, or volcanic eruption, or even a tsunami, you're going to associate it with these tones.
I'm going to look, and I'm going to keep an eye on what's happening. It doesn't have to be a major event. It may only be a 5 or 5.5, but it will be a signature that I need to watch and listen for again. And no matter what I'm doing, this is the kind of sound that will infiltrate anything else you're doing, and all of a sudden you know, oh, the sound has changed, or oh, that's a new sound, even though I have learned how to keep it in the background for my sanity. It's still there all the time.
Wow. So this is not like a ringing of the ears or something you hear in your head. This is actually a physiological detection that you have, right?
Yes, and it has been measured by dual trace spectrum analyzers.
Now, when you say it's been detected, do you mean independently of you or actually hooking up to you?
No, independently of myself. It's been picked up in the atmosphere, in the ground, underwater, and in a sound attenuation booth where they were testing me at the Oregon State School for the Deaf here in Salem. And they went in there with the assumption that it was a tinnitus effect, because the sound was quote-unquote soundproof, the booth. But the sound was real, and according to the report I got, 59 dB higher than their ultimate measurement capability within that attenuation booth, because it was acting as a high bypass filter, thereby blocking out all the higher frequency and only the low frequency could get in.
Yeah, and that's interesting, because, you know, low frequency has the ability to penetrate, where high frequency gets into a destructive interference mode. It has a lot of reflections, but the ELF or even ULF has the ability to actually travel completely around the Earth.
Right. Uh-huh.
Now, you mentioned several different...
Go ahead.
I was gonna ask you. You mentioned several different media there: water and upper atmosphere and Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a distinction between those three different media when you hear the tone?
It's much louder around water. It becomes much louder to me physically if I'm in an enclosed environment like a vehicle or a small room, a bathroom especially because of the tubs, the bathtub and so on. And also when they tested me in Seattle in the hyperbaric decompression chambers and they found that I found the sound was intensely loud there as well.
Yeah, I could see that with a more dense atmosphere. You could have more ability for the vibration to travel through the air to your eardrums.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk a little bit about these three different media. You say it's louder around water. Do you actually have to go to the beach or to a big lake or something like that to pick up this?
No, when I'm traveling around water, like over a bridge or anything, not only the sound it amplifies, but also the pain amplifies that I pick up, because water has a very low frequency, and it amplifies what I'm feeling, almost like a parabolic effect. It accentuates everything that I'm feeling.
Wow. Now, you mentioned the word pain. Is this a painful experience for you to...
Absolutely. I've been in the hospital numerous times from the pain.
Wow.
It can mimic anything from a heart attack to appendicitis to hard labor. It has. And migraines that last for several days on at a time that I have to be sedated for. That's why back in 1981, there was a volunteer project with the Library of Congress coined Project Migraine for a real symptom of the phenomena. And I was part of that project, co-investigator, co-author of that project for 11 years.
Wow. You know, this does make a lot of sense, because the U.S. military does a lot of research with subsonic, what they call non-lethal weaponry, where they actually broadcast high amplitude, low frequency, and I'm talking about tuning it to a fraction of a wavelength, because it has targeted effects on not only human organs, such as the liver and kidneys, bowels, but it can also entrain the brain waves of a human
absolutely.
Being.
Pure Tesla.
Yeah. This is now let's talk about the upper atmosphere effects.
Okay.
I was in 1997 involved in a documentary called Holes in Heaven, where myself and several scientists from around the world were contacted by a very talented producer who put together a documentary on HARP, which, as you know, is the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project. Mm-hmm. And the reason it was interesting to me is I had been doing ground probing radar, what's known as Earth tomography, since the early 80s, specifically in the oil and gas business. And I became disheartened with the industry, so I left it. It was either hot or cold or muddy or snowy or something to do with the terrible smell of oil and gas all the time. But it was instrumental in getting me through my education, so I stuck with it for a while. But in doing that, I learned some very unique phenomena that occur as frequencies interact with one another. And, you know, I had years of experience with this in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And what concerned me was that it boosted the power levels to over a billion watts, and they were beaming it up into the ionosphere just to see what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I became involved with that documentary, because there are some unique combinations, which I discovered purely just by experimentation, that happened in the field. And they happened with very low wattage, like 50 watts. And this resonance, as I demonstrated in the documentary with the piano strings, lines up with substrata in the earth and can be, you know, very, very dangerous to play with, especially with certain geological stresses.
Mm-hmm.
But you are sort of a very unique instrument on the Earth. You've got a sensitivity that nobody I know has. Is it possible that we all have this and we just lose it in the noise of our environment?
I believe that there are many hundreds of thousands of people that are biologically sensitive, not to the degree necessarily that I am, but to some degree. Many, many people feel the same symptoms I do. One of the interesting things about when I put this all together with the symptoms was that I found that not only did I hear and feel these things, but everyone else is sensitive, will feel the same symptom at the same time in the same place in their body, no matter where they live. Thereby, it makes it a very predictable ability.
Wow. So if we had a network of people who were in communication with one another, who
mm-hmm.
knew they had this ability,
mm-hmm.
and let's say they were separated by several thousand miles, and within,
mm-hmm.
say, a five-minute period, they all experienced this sonic effect,
mm-hmm.
it's a pretty good bet something is being generated, at least at an Earth level,
mm-hmm.
that we should pay attention to, wouldn't you say?
Well, yeah, because magnetic fields moving at the speed of light, distance really is not a factor.
Well, yeah, actually, not to correct you, but magnetic
okay.
fields move many, many times faster than distance.
Well, right, exactly, but I'm just using that as an example that if they move that fast, then distance is not a factor.
Well, that's true. I was specifically referring to sonic or these ultra-low frequencies.
Oh, the subsonic sound, uh-huh.
Yeah, they're gonna respond somewhere in the neighborhood of the speed of sound or maybe a little faster because
right.
of the media they're traveling through. But
right. mm-hmm.
if that sound is actually a harmonic that's generated by a magnetic disturbance,
mm-hmm.
then you're absolutely correct. It would be generated simultaneously, instantly, in multiple locations.
Mm-hmm. The first time that when I first became aware of this and started searching for the answers, so to speak, because everybody in my family thought I was crazy and nobody else could hear it, and it led me to start getting phone calls from interested individuals, including the United States Navy, who called and ordered me to cease and desist and not talk about what I was hearing and what I was feeling, because I believe, although they never admitted it, that they were convinced that I was listening to their underwater system of the Trident system in Seattle. Because I was the things that I was explaining, what I was hearing and what it sounded like to them was very much like their system at that time. And I guess they got
well.
Really a little uptight about that. And then they told me the call was being recorded and there was a senior officer on the line, and it was the 13th Naval Command in Seattle, Washington that called. And then I started getting phone calls with very Slavic accents who would not identify themselves, wanting to come and talk with me, only asking, are you the one that hears the earthquakes?
Well, are you saying that they contacted you and told you to cease and desist what? Telling people that you could...
Telling people what I was hearing and what I was feeling and describing it to the media and so on. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, I think, in my opinion, that's a little bit like driving around with a radar detector. If they're going
yeah.
to beam a scanning frequency or a communicating frequency out there,
mm-hmm.
You have the right to know if you're being scanned or not.
I believe that's true.
That's on radar detectors.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I'm
not saying that I would condone breaking the law. And
oh, no, no,
sort
no.
of, you know, trying to get an early warning on breaking the law.
Oh, no,
but,
no, no.
But, you know... Off the coast of Oregon, near where
yep.
you live,
Coos Head.
There's the Juan de Fuca Plate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And off the coast of Oregon, on the sea floor, there's a network of hydrophones. These were
yes, there are.
Set up during World War II
mm-hmm.
To listen to invading or snooping undersea craft that might be poking around out there.
That's true.
But since that time, they've kind of fallen into the hands of private contractors and the USGS, and they've been listening to Mostly an occasional fishing trawler and whales going by. But last year, they recorded about 3 months of very peculiar sounds underneath the Juan de Fuca plate.
Mm-hmm.
And they sounded a lot like lava moving.
Mm-hmm.
But geologists swear up and down, there's no lava underneath the Juan de Fuca plate.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you make of this concentrated period? And I think there were over 1,000 events, sonic
mm-hmm.
events, underneath the Juan de Fuca plate, which is just to give people an idea what could happen if that plate decided to have a major upheaval.
Uh-huh.
If you have a beachfront house on the coast of Oregon, you would be affected by this.
Well, I'll tell you what a gentleman told me who used to work for the Office of Emergency Management. He told me that if the Juan de Fuca plate would go, which would trigger up to a 9-magnitude earthquake off the coast of Oregon and Washington, that every home between Portland, Oregon, and Eugene, Oregon, which is about, let's see, I'm 50 miles south of Portland and 75 miles north of Eugene, so we're talking 125 miles. Every home within that 125 miles would be shaken off their foundation.
Well, not to mention that.
Not to mention the tsunamis and everything else coming in from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. If that plate shifted, you're not talking a 30 or 40 foot tsunami. You're
no, no.
About 400 to 500 meter tsunami.
Probably. Probably would go over our coast range and come right into the Willamette Valley where I'm at. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. Right up by Mount Hood there would just give windsurfing a new name along the
I guess. I guess.
Have you ever seen that? You ever gone down there and watched those windsurfers where the wind comes between the mountains there? It's unbelievable what those guys can do.
Oh, over in the gorge, uh-huh.
Yeah, in the gorge. I mean, it's like the number mm-hmm. one kite surfing. They lift 100 feet off the water and do all kinds of flips and everything.
Well, this week they could have done it on ice.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about that in our second hour because, as I mentioned in the monologue, there is quite an arm wrestling match going on out there over does global warming exist or not. And, mm-hmm. Frankly, the last couple winters, northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, it's snowed in Malibu, it's snowed in Johannesburg and Sydney, Australia.
Snowed in Seaside.
Yeah, and last year in Washington State, they had the deepest snows ever. And
mm-hmm.
they're set to do it again
mm-hmm.
this year. And if you've done any flying lately, those of you flying over the holidays, take a look out the window. 78% of the country is white. And when that happens, we reflect most of our energy right back out into space that comes in from the sun.
Hmm.
Now let's talk a little bit about solar connections with the sound that you hear.
Okay. Well, the solar connections aren't necessarily sound related; they are symptom related. It's a term that I've coined some years ago. I call it solar flu, and solar flu is basically a pressure on the sternum of the body. And it mimics a gallbladder attack, if anyone's ever experienced that. And the pain is absolutely mind-boggling. It really, really gets bad. I was actually taken to the hospital by ambulance, one of the last effects I had back in 98. And that would be our last solar maximum, or thereabouts. And we had had a lot of X flares. We'd had, which is very high on the scale of flares on the sun, and we'd had, I believe, 7 of them in less than 4 days. It was in August, and I just get worse and worse and worse, and I couldn't breathe very well. And my mother came over, and she took one look at me, and she said, "You're going to the hospital." So they called the ambulance, and when they got there, I was cyanotic and in tachycardia, and they took me to the hospital. And of course, they determined, because I told them it was related to the sun, that it was that I was delusional. And it took some time to get that off my record at the hospital. And I told them I didn't think it was fair for them to put that on the record when they were using my information on their wall to treat people back in 1980 during St. Helens when everybody was coming in with the same symptoms. And they gave me IVs, and within 30 minutes the pain was gone, and I went home. And
wow.
I couldn't figure out what had happened because there was no big major flare. But 2 days later, it came out that at that same day that this hit me, we were hit by the largest burst of energy from deep space that we had ever been hit with. And apparently for my body, as much as it was under the strain of all these X-flares, that electromagnetic energy that hit us, that or plasma or whatever it was that hit us, was so intense that it pushed me right over the top and just really made me deathly ill.
Now, what happened in October of 2005 when, very unexpectedly, the sun was heading for its solar minimum, we hadn't had many sunspots, and all of a sudden we had 9 X-class flares in October.
Big ones, X-17s, I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, for that one again, I was...
Majors, satellites, and everything.
Right. I was having the solar flu symptoms again. I was having pain through my back so bad I couldn't even lie down. One of the things I found intriguing was that, although I knew it wasn't my gallbladder, one of the things they use for treating gallbladder colic is across-the-counter preparation called Lefacin. And it's good for the heart as well. So I started taking 1,600 milligrams capsules of Lefacin. And if I took two of those and a antacid, one of the well-known antacids, the pain would stop in 10 minutes. And the doctor said, well, that means it was gallbladder. And I said, no, it doesn't, because I had 8 people in my email group that were experiencing the same symptoms. 3 of those people had their gallbladders removed, and they were still getting the symptoms.
That's interesting. That's very interesting.
The thing that intrigues me about it is when our forefathers, Socrates, Plato, these people, when they determine the names for the human body, why would they call this the solar plexus, the only part of the body that's named after anything other than here that is related to the sun, unless it was solar in some way, and so it would be affected by the sun, so they call it the solar plexus.
How interesting. That is quite fascinating. I never actually put that together, the solar plexus being tied into the sun, that our bodies somehow are attuned to solar energy or solar activity.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Very mm-hmm. interesting. Now let me bring this subject around. You were working at a local YMCA in April of 1980, and we all know in the Northwest how significant that date was.
Oh yeah.
And Mount St. Helens was doing some rumbling, but long before people thought that this would actually turn into an eruption, you began sounding off and making people take notice. And you actually had a remarkable prediction about the eruption of Mount St. Helens. Can you go into that for us?
Yes. From the 16th of March of 1980 forward, I've had a constant migraine headache. It's never gone away. It doesn't respond to medication because it's external of the body. And I've learned to live with it. There are times when it really gets bad, and then I realize how bad it was originally because now I'm used to my original, quote-unquote, St. Helens headache. But on the 16th of March of 1980, I got the migraine. I waited 3 days to see what would happen, and nothing happened. I thought, wow, that's weird. And then on the fourth day, they had the first earthquake on St. Helens, and of it, the one that they were quite aware of it when it happened, and they were kind of monitoring it after that. And I was being interviewed by a journalist from San Francisco, and we were sitting in the park here in Salem, and it was on the 20th of March, and he wanted me to make these faces so he could take pictures, because it's hard to describe something in a story without a photo to go with it. And he wanted me to grimace and push this and point there and so on. I said, I'm not going to do that. You know, that's ridiculous. Well, a few minutes later, here's tears rolling down my face and my head was pounding. And he says, oh, that's perfect. Well, I won't tell you what I told him. But anyway,
yeah,
I said, that's the mountain. And we ran for the car and turned on the radio. And sure enough, the earthquake had hit and caused an ash event. And it was the first ash eruption, and St. Helens became an active volcano in the United States. And from that point on, it was one event after the other. And I was working at the YMCA in April. And I had gotten up from my chair to walk to my boss's desk across the hall, the room from me, and I walked opposite direction and walked right into a wall. I had no control over where I was walking. My hands on my face, I went into the ladies' room and washed my face off because I was totally embarrassed. And my hands and face were both spotted with what they call petechiae, which is bleeding under the skin. And I had little blood spots all over my face and my hands. And I knew at that point that I could no longer work and be a functional working person. And so I resigned immediately and went home. And from that point on, it was just one event after the other on the mountain. Later that day in April, there was a 5.0 quake on St. Helens, with an ash event that went up quite high without an eruption with it. And then in May, I was in contact with various scientists and so on, talking to them about the mountain. And I'd been talking to a gentleman by the name of Rick Tell. Rick was with the US EPA, the United States Environmental Protection Agency, from Las Vegas, Nevada, and he wanted to come out and see me. And so I called him on the 12th of May, and I said, if you want to see that mountain blow, you better get out here. And so he showed up on the Thursday before the eruption, and I told him that it was really going to blow and that, you know, he better have his equipment ready. And then the next day I was at the TV station in Portland that was doing a lot of things with me at that time, and we went to dinner or to lunch, and I couldn't stand up straight to walk. I was walking at about I was listing, I guess you'd have to say, and I was bumping into things, and again I had the bleeding under the skin on my hands and face, and I was getting scared, and I had been asked to stop at the Lake Oswego High School on the way back. One of the students had called me, and I was their science project. And they wanted me to come in and talk to the class. So I said, okay, well, I'll do that. So I stopped at Lake Oswego on the way home and went upstairs and sat in the science class. And if anybody remembers science classes, you remember the metal tables. Well, everything I touched in that room was vibrating. I could feel the vibration. I asked other students if they could feel it. They did not feel it. And I told them, I said, be aware. I said, all hell is going to break loose on Mount St. Helens this weekend. And that was on Friday night. And then I came home, and everything was okay. And the next day was kind of quiet. And then my husband took my two sons and decided to go out of town, go camping or fishing or something. I don't remember. And my daughter had a friend over. And I was just watching TV. And then the headache hit so severely. And I laid down, and I got up to change the TV station, which was kitty-corner from me, and again, I walked right into a wall. This time I walked into the fireplace, and I sat down on the floor and was laughing, and then I got really scared, and I thought, uh-oh, this is it. And I picked up the phone and called ABC Television in Portland, and I talked to a guy named, Tom, and Tom was their editor, and Tom Brown, and then also Doug Crombie, who was at that time their one of the people that I'd been working with, and then Stan Wilson, who was one of their network anchor people. And I said, you guys want to know when that mountain's going to blow? I said, it's going to blow in 12 hours. I said, log my call for 8:20 p.m. And it blew in 12 hours, and 12 minutes later it blew.
Wow. So did they interview you after that? Did they put
you know, I don't,
on,
I
on
not
the
to the not to the degree I would have expected. Everybody was so busy with the mountain, it was sort of out of everybody's mind until much later. But I was on again. I was on with numerous eruptions. Actually, I was on the set a couple times that we got talking and we went right through the sports cast. They didn't even get to do a sports cast. But I hit every eruption of Mount St. Helens, every explosive eruption of Mount St. Helens. I have not missed one of them, including the one when I was in Sacramento living there in, 19, I believe it was 82 or 83. And, again, it was in March and, it was August. And, I had a friend in and we'd gone to dinner and came back and we came into the kitchen and I passed out. And they said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "St. Helens is going to blow." And they said, "When?" And I've never done this in my life before or since. I said, 12 days. And it did blow with an explosive eruption 12 days later. And
well,
the network.
Do you think that your public warnings do you think it was an awareness event for people that lived near the mountain? Did they, obviously there are a lot of people that live near the mountain, live on the mountain, and were affected by that eruption, but something or someone warned them that something was imminent and it was time to pack a bag
and get out of there? Yes, the body has this mechanism that's a fight or flight, and you pay attention to that when you feel it. Absolutely. You can't really describe it, but it's there.
And a friend who was camping in and around Bryce National Park in Bryce Canyon, Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Utah is pretty dry. It's not, especially southern Utah, not prone to thunderstorms or flash floods or anything like that, but he had his six children, and the typical station wagon kind of camping, you know, pull up to the picnic table, get out the tents, and they had just done so, and had planned to stay 2 or 3 days at this camping facility where there are several camping sites in a local park, and no sooner had they got it unpacked and got a couple tents done, and he said, "You know what? We need to put everything back in the car, and we're going to go up the road about 20 more miles." And they said, "What? I mean, come on. We haven't even explored, you know, the first hill." And he said, nope, we're doing it." So they took down the tents, packed up the car, and it was almost dusk. And they went up 20 miles and set up in the dark and had a good time. That night, there was a thunderstorm on the other side of the mountain. They never even saw it. But the flood came through the ravine and wiped that campsite out. They would have lost their lives if he would have stayed. Something, some vibration that he felt clued him in, and he didn't brush it aside. He followed it, and he probably saved the lives of his children. No doubt
about
it.
Gave me the chills. Yes, I believe that. That's
perhaps anciently, and I'm going back into anthropology here, perhaps well before what we think is the beginning of time.
Mm-hmm.
We probably had these abilities. At least the shaman of the village had the abilities. And in those days, the shaman was highly respected. If he had a feeling that it was time to pack a bag, everybody did so. Nobody questioned him.
Right.
Today, these days, we have a shaman. We have a sensitive. We have a Charlotte King who is at least receptive enough to have a physiological switch that goes off in her, whether it shows up as broken blood vessels beneath the skin, a migraine, or an organ pain. And our community, our society, has chosen in its intelligence and in its maturity to ignore that warning. What do you think we can do in this enlightened age to reestablish the sensitive, the Charlotte Kings in the society so that perhaps we know what is coming?
Well, I think, as I said, I think that everyone to some degree is sensitive. I think that after a period of time of being hit or assailed with the symptom or the frequencies, that you reach a point where your body says enough already and you start responding to those frequencies. And I believe personally that it's not something particularly you want to go searching for. It isn't a whole lot of fun sometimes. It's been a blessing, and it's definitely been a curse. I think that people need to be open-minded, though, and I do believe that there are many, as I said, many, many others out there that are biologically sensitive or feel these things to some degree, some as much as I do, some much less. I haven't, and there's some that hear sound and some that just feel pain. I know very few that have sound and pain, maybe only one other person, but they hear high frequency, I hear low frequency. So, the U.S. Bureau of Standards Magnetic Testing Laboratories in Boulder, Colorado, in August of 81, they found out that not only could I hear 10, 12, 2, whatever hertz, but I could pick up and identify all the harmonics of these sounds as well.
Ooh, we have a caller online, too. Wow, that is just fascinating. Charlotte, we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
This is Ramon from New York.
Hello, Ramon. Welcome to the program.
How are you guys doing? I actually have a few questions. The first question was, have you been able to, map the area where you're at just by these feelings and vibrations?
The symptoms go with different geographical locations, and I've learned to identify what symptom goes with what area pretty much throughout the United States and other parts of the world.
Okay, and my other question is probably a question Dr. Agnes will appreciate. Have you, by any chance, been able to feel the shape of the earth? Is it solid? Is it hollow? Or it doesn't go that far?
You know, I've never tried to do that. I've done some dowsing. And when I was in California, I was contacted by a major oil company wanting to know if I could feel various types of oil or gas or whatever underground. But then that project all of a sudden was canceled for some reason. I don't know what happened. They never contacted me again. So I really don't, as far as hollow or whatever, I don't know. I think that if I'm on granite, I feel a lot more than if I'm not on granite. But other than that, I don't know of any really major changes in where I'm located.
And the last thing was, I've noticed, I remember when I was a kid, at least here on the East Coast, I remember the leaves falling in back, like middle of October, it starts turning yellow, beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've noticed even late November, they're still green.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't nowhere near have the witches we used to have on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. I'll listen offline. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ramon. Thank you very much. Interesting questions. We get, very astute listeners, and they ask questions that sometimes, the guests can answer right off, and some that really make them stretch.
Yeah.
One of the things that he brought up, and I'm kind of interested in it myself, is that the mapping that you've been able to do, the association of different frequencies with different geographical locations. So when you
mm-hmm.
get a pattern that you're used to, one that you have heard before,
mm-hmm.
you associate it with a geographical location and a possible event. And
mm-hmm.
what is your, do you have a network that you notify people that you?
I have an email subscription group, which I send out emails kind of semi-regularly. If things are really active, they get many more than if they're not active, sometimes up to two or more in a day if things are very active or something is building or changing. It's free service, and all anyone has to do is just email me and sign up for the to be on the list. The
if you want to give out that address, you
oh sure, I'm sorry. Yes, it's just Char King. That's C H A R K I N G, one word, lowercase. At Visor, that's V like Victor, I, S like Sam, E-R, dot net.
Okay, we've got that out there. We have about 5 minutes left in this hour. I want to kind of lay the groundwork maybe for the next hour. I want to talk about some earth changes that seem to be taking place. Whether they're related to global warming or not, I don't know. We may or may not be able to gather some data on that. But it is clear that the Earth, the solar system, is getting ready to pass through the galactic plane. Many ancient civilizations have predicted this event. It is supposed to culminate, to peak on December 21st, 2012, which happens to be the winter solstice of that year. Is it going to be cataclysmic? Is it going to be an Earth event of notoriety? Or is it just going to be another year? And are we really headed for drastic lifestyle changes on our planet? In other words, those of you that live in Oregon, are you going to need to wear that parka year-round? are we headed into an ice age?
Uh-huh.
The sun is doing things no solar scientist has a clue about. No sunspots for over 300 days. We've had some CMUs, that's a coronal mass ejection, or CMEs. But the solar wind has been pretty steady, and the proton count pretty low, and the sun's been very quiet. Some say that the sun is actually in meditation. What are your feelings on this?
I think that without the sunspots, I think that it seems to, I don't know if it does or not, but it seems to cause a cooler weather pattern. But as far as the sun being quiet, not necessarily so. There may not be sunspots, but it's still active because I'm still getting solar symptoms. I wear gold rings. They're 18 karat gold. And before solar events, whether it be a coronal hole opening up or a major solar wind coming through and bombarding the Earth, my fingers turn black from the change in my pH balance that affects the metal on my skin. And that's one of the solar effects I get. The other is intense heartburn, and that happens before CMEs, full or partial halos, filament collapses, or that type of event on the sun. And those have also transpired. Not necessarily the actual big flares that come from the sunspots, but if you go to the KP indexes on the solar website, sometimes we still get the green, yellow, which is a change, or the red bars that show that the Earth is being hit with something.
Right, right. Yeah, it's and those events that you just mentioned are all extremely powerful electromagnetic events
mm-hmm.
on the surface of the sun, not necessarily mm-hmm. resulting in a flare or a spot, but definitely huge electromagnetic polarity shifts, and they've even been called cosmic bullets by NASA. And I'd like to go into a little more detail on that in the next hour. This is X Squared Radio. It's a three-hour program. We are dispensing with commercials tonight. We're going to play some music for you because you've probably been commercial to death this time of year, so we're not going to add to that. Just let you listen to music for about 2.5 minutes, and we'll be back after these messages. Just after this.
Did you get home, your brother?
Chill for a while, and we'll be back.
Huh? I'm not going to do that.
right. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're glad you're with us tonight. Got some interesting news to share with you. Here at X Squared Radio, we often talk about where the past meets the future, and we also talk about phenomena that occur as we begin 2009 next week. We are now entering our fifth year on the air with BBS Radio, proud members we are. And we also come to you through the Steel Eye Media Network via Kevin Smith, our friend down there. Interesting, the moon could hold water for a lunar base, say scientists. Craters on the moon could hold ice to provide astronauts with a crucial water supply and make a lunar base possible. Scientists believe lunar ice could be hidden in the moon's polar craters, which are untouched by the sun's rays. The findings mean the moon could provide a source of water for astronauts using the satellite as a base for further exploration of the solar system. Dr. Vincent Ecce of the Institute of Computational Cosmology at Durham University analyzed data from a space probe sent to the moon by NASA in 1998. They found high concentrations of hydrogen in polar craters, where temperatures dropped to lower than minus 338 degrees Fahrenheit. That's just a little colder than it is outside right now. The hydrogen could have combined with oxygen present in moon rock to make water. By the way, that chemical reaction is quite exothermic. So it could be a source of heat and energy for electricity and for mechanical devices all over the moon. Dr. Ecce said if the hydrogen was present as lunar ice, there could be as much as 200 million liters of water in the top meter of the moon. That's very significant. Meanwhile, down here on Earth, just a week ago, stymieing thousands of commuters and travelers, snow shut Interstate 15 over 4,190-foot Cajon Pass east of Los Angeles and roads through the San Gabriel Mountains connecting metropolitan Los Angeles to the commuter suburbs of Palmdale and Lancaster in the high desert to the north. Interstate 5, a major trucking and travel route connecting Southern California with the Central Valley and Northern California, stayed open over the 4,144-foot Tejon Pass most of the day with on and off highway patrol escorts, and then finally was shut down in the afternoon as conditions deteriorated. Massive backups developed below all the passes. Now, the reason I'm mentioning these two pieces is NASA is planning on revisiting the moon by 2020. And in a big way, they're going to build a base there that's capable of launching probes further out into space. Obviously, the low gravity conditions on the moon would make the energy requirements for breaking the orbit of the moon much, much more financially feasible than trying to break the gravitational field of Earth, not to mention the fact that on Earth we have to plow our way through weather and our atmosphere, which, as you know, in recent years has been rather catastrophic for the NASA experts, and craft have to be specially designed to take 10,000-mile-an-hour speeds through the lower atmosphere. That won't be a problem on the moon, and it's a smart idea. We're sorry to see that it has taken till 2020 to get it done, but we've met some of the young talent, and it is impressive. Just the night before last, met a young NASA co-op student who is working for NASA, and lots of very neat rover programs going on. Also in the news, new species are popping up, thousands of them, and actually 88 new species of frogs were discovered, including the blue-spotted tree frog. In Greater Mekong, which is made up of 600,000 square kilometers of wetlands and rainforest along the Mekong River in Cambodia, Laos, Burma, Thailand, Vietnam, and China, it's also home to striped rabbits, bright pink millipedes laced with cyanide, and a rat that was believed to have become extinct 11 million years ago. Well, all these characters are back and more. And actually, zoologists are a little confused as to why these species are now making a re-entry into the ecology of Earth. In this hour, our guest is Charlotte King. She has been considered a human seismograph. She is capable of sensing ELF, ULF, and VLF frequencies that are precursors to seismic events, cosmological events, and maybe even Earth changes. And that's what we're going to talk about this hour. We have all noticed, especially if you pay attention to this program, the absence of sunspots. They don't talk about it much on the mainstream news because the absence of something isn't really exciting. But in the solar science world, we are supposed to be well into solar cycle number 24. We're supposed to have sunspots on our sun and be, you know, crescendoing, building up to 2012, which is now 4 years away, almost exactly December 21st, 2012. We are supposed to be at a solar maximum, and we are supposed to be building up to another very predictable pole shift, a solar pole shift. And everyone's a little confused as to the absence. Everybody's geared up. They've got their grant money, their detection equipment ready, their programs written, their theses developed. But the sun is a no-show. And it's quite possible that our guest tonight, Charlotte King, may have some insight as to why the sun is so quiet, and at least quiet with respect to sunspots. So let's see if we can get into this a little bit, and maybe later in the hour we'll talk about perhaps drastic climate changes that may be laying the groundwork as we speak. Charlotte, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
I have to tell you, I am so fascinated with the Northwest of the United States. It is an incredible record of tremendous seismic forces at work on our Earth. From Portland all the way to the Canadian border, the Earth displays an overthrust of activity, of raw basalt thrust into the surface, and tremendous 1,000-foot-high floods, 20,000 years ago. It's a tremendous place of geological upheaval. But now it seems so peaceful and so beautiful and so ecologically balanced. You live in the area. What is your feeling about the Northwest and its
pristine beauty? I think Northwest is an extremely seismically active area right now. I think it's been that way for quite some time, even prior to St. Helens, because of the quakes in Washington and the quakes in Alaska and so on that affected us here in the Pacific Northwest, mainly Oregon and that area. And we had one of the things that people talk about is, you know, how much they hate the earthquakes and hate the volcanoes. And I said, well, you like Silver Creek Falls and you like the rivers and the mountains. I said, that's all part of the volcanic activity and seismic activity that is ongoing. That's what formed all these beautiful places that people go to visit. And that kind of gave them pause for thought, you know, that it's a constantly changing environment. We had a quake here in, we called it our Spring Break quake in March of 1993, March 25th, and it was a 5.7. I had experienced earthquakes when I lived in Sacramento for a few years, and they were kind of rolling, little wavy things, not particularly severe. This quake that we had here, I was four blocks from the river here in Salem during that quake. I knew it was coming. The cats had been hiding all day and roof-sitting, the ones that weren't hiding. I have cats that are very sensitive and at that time. And they would get on the roof and sit for 2 to 3 days. They wouldn't come in. And others would climb in cupboards or under the bed or whatever. And anyway, when I found 7 cats under the waterbed, it was the captain's bed, hiding together, that 2 of them were mortal enemies, I knew we were in trouble. And we had a major invasion of ants. Ants are a major precursor for seismic and volcanic activity. And it doesn't have to be right where you are. And then I had made the prediction for the quake. I was getting the symptoms. For Oregon, it's mid-upper back pain, like you've been hit with a baseball bat. It is, for me, this particular quake, it was a sore throat, it was earaches, and your vision, you think you're going blind. You can see, but you cannot focus. And that's a classic symptom for Oregon only. And I was home. I had gotten up. I couldn't sleep. I was in that mode of hyperactivity that I get before a big event. And I made a cup of tea. I opened the patio doors because I knew if a quake hit, the cats would run right into the glass door, not even thinking. So I opened the patio doors and came and sat down. And then I got up and went in the kitchen. The next thing I knew, I walked back in, and I had one cat who, before a big earthquake, he would jump up and hang on the curtains with his toenails. And he was hanging on my drapes about 4 feet off the floor. So I thought, okay, this is a pretty good indication we're in trouble. So I got him off, got him to relax, and I went to sit down. I barely sat on the sofa, and the quake hit. And it was like a truck had hit the house. And each time it went sideways, and it felt like it was going sideways, it would crack. And it would go the other way and crack. And I timed it for 45 seconds. And that was a long earthquake.
Oh, yeah.
And when I went outside, although there was no damage to speak of in the house, the patio had dropped 2 inches. And the drain pipes that come down the spouts on the side of the house where the metal bands are, go around them to hold them to the house, that was 2 inches below where it was painted. It was bare where they had dropped, so I knew it really did drop. It popped all the nails out of the siding on one side of the house and out of the gutters. And the interesting thing about this quake was that I thought it was volcanic. And everybody says, no, it isn't. And I said, well, I'm sure it is. It feels volcanic. So I went over to the area of the epicenter and got one of the city officials to take me around. And he was glad to do it because he had a couple things he wanted to show me. And he was driving around. He said, well, how do you feel here? And I said, oh, this is much worse than this area. I'm going to be ill. And he said, oh, this is the area where a house slid. And then we go a little further, and he said, now what are you feeling? And I said, oh, this is okay, but right here, I said, this is bad. And he said, oh, this is where they did the most damage on the quake. And we went on, and pretty soon I told him, I said, this is not good. What's in here? I said, I keep feeling volcanic activity. He said, get out of the car, come with me. And so we walked up to this house that had flower pots upside down all over the edge of the driveway. And he turned them upside down, and they were little tiny boiling mud pots. So it was volcanic in origin, because these little mud pots were sitting there bubbling away on the edge of the driveway. And so I felt vindicated.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the epicenter was actually in Oregon, as you predicted?
It was at between Molalla, Oregon, and Cottage Grove. It was the Gales Creek Fault, they called it. And it moved just a tiny bit. And the weird thing is, after a quake of 5.7, you would expect, you know, quite a few aftershocks. I don't think we've had 5 aftershocks since that quake hit. And for me, that tells me it locked up even tighter than it was before, and I know that it's going to let go again. Not quite sure yet when, but I know it's going to, and I know I will know when it does.
Well, I'm just going to say this several times tonight, but when you have that feeling and you know when it's going to happen,
mm-hmm.
Feel free to contact me, and we'll put it on the air immediately.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And
you have to understand, too, you know, that nothing, and I'll be the first to admit, nothing is 100%, okay? And so you have to take everything and understand that it's being given in the sense of, based on what I have felt in the past, this is what I'm expecting.
Well, yeah,
because
I
you can't just go out and say, I predict this or I predict that, because I base all of my predictions or forecasts, as I like to use the term instead of prediction, all my forecasts on past experience. So when I have something new, as I did with that new sound, then it is a new event for me, and I can't make any kind of a forecast about what it means because I really don't know what it means.
Sure.
You know?
One of the friends of X Squared Radio has been on a couple of times is Stan Deo.
I know Stan.
He had access to the Navy's database for a few years and managed draw a correlation between thermal signatures and earthquake predictions, and he got really good at it. So good, in fact, that we don't really know if this is the reason, but it certainly was coincidental. The Navy blocked Stan Deo from further access to the Navy's database from which he drew this critical information, and so now he can't make as accurate predictions as he had in the past, but he had, even the one off the coast of Florida, he nailed it to the day, to the intensity, and to the epicenter, which was really good. Now, the interesting thing, how this correlates with what you're feeling, is the thermal signatures are generated by friction, pressure, and frequency in the Earth itself. So what he is picking up with a satellite and a naval database, from a satellite information, you're picking up with your body, with your, you know, 3D presence.
Well, there was one time that Stan had put out a alert or a heads up kind of signal to everybody, and he was they were showing the Navy pictures of the coastline off of Oregon being very red, you know, very hot, and I said, no, I don't feel that. You know, and if I don't feel it, it's not going to happen. I don't care what it shows. And I said, but Stan, watch your area, because something is building in Australia. And it looked pretty cool over there. And so we did not have a quake here, but he did have a quake there. And I was going on symptom, not the color codes that they use in the military for those that website that he was watching so closely, and he was very good. I think Stan was amazing, and I still think he is amazing. I think he's very good at what he did. He did a lot of groundbreaking work in his field on that.
Oh, I believe so too. And the interesting thing is that, you know, the Earth, although, you know, tensions do build up, and you know, thermal signatures exist or don't exist. It doesn't necessarily mean that the earthquake is going to release in that manner. It may release in another way.
Another area,
Right. It's sort of like traffic in Los Angeles. Everyone will slow down to 10 miles an hour, and you go, oh, gee, there must be a wreck. There must be a citation event going on. And you get up there, and there's nothing. And
nothing
then
there.
Traffic just mysteriously picks up on its own.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those things that will release in another way.
Well, I know the one of the events that I picked up on back in 1981, I took my son to the coast for his birthday, and it was the 5th of June, and I could instantly, as soon as we got over there, I could feel the change in the vibration of what I was feeling normally, and there had been I have to call it a beaching, for lack of another word, of what they call vela vela, which are little blue sailfish that, or jellyfish that come in off the coast. And the whole beach was littered with them. I mean, it just reeked. It was really bad. And my daughter was running along the edge of the beach and playing in the water and so on. And I kept listening to the CB from, at that time, CBs, and the fishermen out the ship to shore, and they were complaining there was no salmon, there was no crabs, because they had all gone to deeper water or farther out, and they thought it was the the warm temperatures. And I said, oh, no, it's the warm water. We've got a volcano going off over here somewhere. So I contacted Chris Dodge, who was my co-investigator and head of Project Migraine, and I told him, I said, Chris, we've got an active volcano off the Oregon coast. I said, I've gone to doors and knocked on people's doors and asked them if they could hear anything or feel anything. Some said they felt vibrations. Others just shut the door in my face. But I said, that's okay. I said, but something's going on. I want you to log my call. So he did. 3 months later, they found the big volcano off the coast of Newport, 250 miles out, the one that they sent the Alvin submarine down to take pictures, and they found all these new species of tube worms and various other deep sea creatures that they had never seen before. And but I had picked it up 3 months before they found it.
Where do you think the new species came from?
I think they've always been there. I think they just probably, or either they've been there all along and we didn't know it, or they changed so abruptly from one stage to another to be able to survive in the either extreme heat or extreme cold temperatures without light that there was at that depth in the ocean.
Ah, so perhaps dormant eggs laying on the bottom for thousands of years. And then all of a sudden a thermal event happens and they say, okay,
it activates them just like the pine cones dropping their seeds during a forest fire.
Right, right. How interesting. Yeah, you have a sudden ecological change, then you're going to have a sudden flora or fauna change as well.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Now, you mentioned the word beaching, and I wanted to talk about this subject as well, because human beings, although not noted for their ability to hear extremely low frequencies, are a little like whales. Whales hear extremely low frequencies, and those frequencies travel literally around the world. So what is the event that causes whales to beach, and have you actually predicted or felt a whale beaching before, and explain that?
Actually, Brooks, the very first prediction I ever made was on the beaching of whales in Oregon at Florence on the Oregon coast in 1979. And I had been talking to the television station a lot in Portland and been giving them information. The sound changed and there'd be an event, and the sound changed, there'd be an event. But I didn't know anything about locations or anything at that point. It was just sound, no symptoms to speak of. And the morning of the of that morning in June of 79, I was just really kind of spacey, disoriented, but I didn't think much about it. By that evening, I was very hyper, and I couldn't sleep. And I called the TV station. I said, what's going on? And they said, nothing's happening. And I said, check your wire service. They said, no, nothing's happening, earthquake-wise. So I was laying there watching television, and shortly after midnight, they interrupted the, on a Saturday night, they interrupted the program to tell us that there was a series of sperm whales beaching on the Oregon coast. In all, we lost 41 whales. They were between 20 and 30 tons and 20 and 30 feet long. It was probably one of the saddest things I ever witnessed. And they would take the smaller ones and push them back into the water, and they'd come right back out and beach themselves again. Well, at this particular time, we were fortunate enough, if you want to use that term, to have the International Mammalogy Convention, which happened to be meeting in Corvallis, Oregon here, about 30 miles from my home. And so they had a working laboratory on the spot, and they all headed over to the coast. And many of the whales they had to put down with massive doses of poison, because with their body weight out of the ocean, they were actually cooking themselves, literally, from the heat. And so they did that, and I told them, I said, well, I know the whales beached because they heard the same thing I'm heard, and they became confused. And they said, no, that wasn't possible. And they had parasites, or they had followed a dominant male, or one of them was sick and they followed the other ones, that type of thing. And I said, no, I know that they came in because of the sound changing. There was something in the water that frightened them. Well, 4 days after the beaching, or actually 3 days and a half after the beaching, there were 4 moderate earthquakes in Big Bear, California. And I thought, ah, that was it. The earthquake caused the sound created the disturbance, the whales came and beached, and that put it all together for me. So one of the chapters in the book I'm writing is called Death Becomes a Teacher, because if this hadn't happened, I don't know how much longer it would have been before I finally put it all together. And I have based 5 predictions based solely on whale beachings, and they've been accurate. I predicted a quake in Santa Cruz, California in 1984 in August, after they had a major beaching of anchovies, and I called them and told them that there was going to be a big earthquake, and they said, oh, these beach once in a while, and I said, is there earthquakes afterward? And they said they didn't remember, and I said, well, there will be, and 2 days later they had a moderate 4.8 or 5.2 or something earthquake there. And any time the pilot whales beach, whether it's on the East Coast or in Florida or in Australia, whatever, quakes always happen near the bay in San Francisco. That's where the quakes happen from that particular beaching. So the whales are also attuned to certain frequencies. And so when we had if you remember back in 81 or 82, we had the humpback whale, Humphrey, and he would get caught in the bay in San Francisco and he couldn't get out. And they followed him up the Sacramento River one time, and he got locked in there, and he finally came out and got into the bay, and he kept circling, but he wouldn't leave. And I called them at the Steinhardt Aquarium, and I said, once that quake hits tonight, and there will be a quake tonight, I said, he'll be gone. And the quake hit, and he was gone. And so I believe the bridge was acting as a parabolic and focusing that frequency or that vibration into the water, and he was feeling it, and he was frightened to go underneath the bridge. But once the quake happened, it was open, and he could take off and go. And that happened on 2 separate occasions.
One of our previous guests on this program was a woman named Joan Ocean. She got a lot of experience with dolphins and whales.
Mm-hmm.
And she was swimming with a group off the coast of Cuba, pretty deep water.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, at least in U.S. waters, it is illegal to swim with whales.
Mm-hmm.
I guess activists have stopped the human whale interaction, but off the coast of Cuba, it's still allowed. And so she does this snorkeling. She doesn't do it with scuba gear, and she's quite capable of free diving to depths beyond what normal swimmers can do, maybe, perhaps 20 meters. And she's doing this kind of deep snorkeling with the whales, and the whales did a very peculiar thing, which she related to me. The whales turned themselves on their nose with their tails straight up, and they
mm-hmm.
made what she characterized as a chant, and it was a very low frequency chant. She said she couldn't hear it with her ears, but
mm-hmm.
she's immersed in the same medium the whales are,
right.
The seawater.
Uh-huh.
The vibration that these whales made, and she said it looked like they were chanting to the earth. Now,
uh-huh.
off the coast of Cuba, the shallow part is about 1,200 feet. It goes down to 6,500
wow.
feet off the coast.
Uh-huh.
So there they are in this open water, and these whales are standing on their tails, and they're chanting in this very low frequency, 30 minutes to a chant, and then they would repeat it. And the vibrations are going through her body, and she's got emotions, crying in the seawater with reverence for this event.
Wow.
That she just describes as you know, almost seismic in the amplitude with which
mm-hmm.
these whales would use their sinus cavities to make these sounds.
Wow.
And it was like they went into a trance. She said it was just amazing to watch. But there appeared to be communication going from the whales to the earth itself, down deep
mm-hmm.
into the ocean. And maybe these sounds went all around the globe. I don't know. But she said that, you know, they weren't traveling. They were staying in this area and enjoying the moment. That's what the whales were doing. They were consciously broadcasting a very low frequency into the earth. And I found that so fascinating, and I thought maybe there would be a correlation here, that the earth perhaps communicates with these primal animals, who, by the way,
the whales are the caretakers.
A lot more gray matter than we do. So maybe they know what they're doing.
Yeah, I think the whales are the caretakers. I think they're wonderful species.
You know, it's interesting when you go to Hawaii and you look at the ancient culture. You talk to the kahunas there, and out of the blue, I just asked one of them, you know, why don't you have, you know, dolphins in your ancient lore? You know, you talk about whales, but there's no dolphins, and there's dolphins everywhere around this island.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't hesitate. He said, well, the reason is because they're a recent addition to the earth. They weren't here. In ancient times. That was very fascinating.
Yeah, would be.
So, this relationship between earth frequency and you, with respect to sound, has been a painful one for you, hasn't it?
It has been a very painful one, and more physically and emotionally as well, yeah.
Well, let's talk about both aspects, because...
Okay.
Gosh, we don't want to be in pain living here on the earth. If we get in sync with these frequencies, we don't want to have, you know, gallbladder attacks or fake heart attacks or high blood pressure events or blurred vision. What can we do to acclimate to the frequencies of the earth? And maybe one more question with it. Do you think the frequencies of the earth are changing?
Okay, I'll answer the first question first. Acclimating oneself to this is something that I still have not been able to do. I can go several days sometimes without too much problem, and then it'll just be all of a sudden like walking into a brick wall, and all bets are off. You know, I have all the symptoms, and I'm sick, and I have to call in, and you don't really want to call your boss and say there's going to be an earthquake, I got to stay home.
That would be a little strange, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, fortunately, I've had bosses where I could do that. At this point, I don't. And it's been difficult because in the past, it's been emotionally trying for me. It ended an 18-year marriage. It cost me my home, my family, my children. It's cost me jobs, it's cost me friendships. In a different aspect of the sensitivity, it's cost the lives of three friends. And it's something that you can't turn off once you have it. And some people will resonate more with one area than another. Some people, it seems to me like since St. Helens, and that's when I began to notice all of this, although I'm sure it probably happened prior to that. But each time there's a major event somewhere, I get a whole new group of people that contact me that have become sensitized and are asking questions and want to know more about what's happening. I think, as I said before, your body reaches a point where it can't throw it off anymore. And so one of these events, whether it be a quake in Turkey or a quake in Japan or a quake in China or a quake in California, it will trigger that group of people to where they start feeling these events and will make them aware that they are also biologically sensitive. And go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, looking back in anthropological history, the shamans, the sensitives of various communities, may have had the same physiological side effects that you do, because, you know, if you go back and look at the cave drawings or look at Egyptian hieroglyphs or look at Mayan codexes, you see the use of drugs. And it's possible that the shamans weren't using the drugs to enhance the effect, but perhaps to dull...
To dampen it down a little bit.
Effects.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. Well, when I first started, I tried biofeedback, and that worked really well until I started affecting the machinery, because the true Charlotte King effect isn't necessarily just picking these things up and feeling them. It's also transmitting what I'm picking up. So if I'm in a room with people that are sensitive, I make them quite ill, literally make them quite ill. One of the doctors who was testing me in California at Modesto became so ill working with me, he went home and went to bed, and he never spoke to me again. He never finished the tests. I called to reach him on several occasions, and he wouldn't talk to me at all. It frightened him, I guess, to the point that he just didn't want any part of it.
Yep,
and,
I've heard that before, too.
I did some stuff with a Reiki master, and I told him, you know, what had happened in the past, that he should protect himself, and he said, I'll be fine. And I said, well, just be aware of it. So he started working with me, and he came up to me later, and he says, I'm sure glad you told me that. He says, I can barely stay around your energy. And I go under street lights, and they go out. Anything infrared I affect, whether it be money machines, stamp machines, soda machines, electronic doors going out of a store more than once. I've slammed into them with my cart. They don't open. Lights go on or off in the parking lot as I walk under them. Car batteries died mysteriously several times prior to St. Helens eruptions, and until I replaced the battery twice, I realized it was me that was affecting the battery. And the battery would lose polarity. It was a combination. It was me, and it was also the energy field, the magnetic field at that time. But I think it happened more likely often because of it was mixing with my own energy. Because I would go to the store, the car would be fine. I'd come out of the store, and I couldn't start it. But 4 hours later, it would start just fine, but it wouldn't. You couldn't jump start it. At one point, before one or two of the eruptions, I had calls from the newsroom at the TV station in Portland asking me if there was going to be an eruption, and I said, yes, I told you it would be. Why? And they said, well, we've got four people with dead batteries this morning at the parking lot. And
I got to tell you, perhaps a coincidence here. I'm not really affected by the low frequencies. I don't necessarily feel them or make predictions like that, but I wipe out the electronic room keys to hotels. I do a lot of traveling. And I wipe out. And the other thing is, my body interrupts the Bluetooth signal.
Uh-huh.
I can't use a Bluetooth because even if the phone is 3 inches away from the Bluetooth, and I've had the best Plantronics make several models and several cell phones.
I'm aware.
My body interrupts the Bluetooth signal.
That's what I did when I was in California with Sprint. Every time I'd be on the phone, within 5 minutes, it would go to dial tone. We'd call up and be talking. It'd go to dial tone, and I would talk to them in Greensboro and work with them on their from the company, and they said, you just can't use Sprint. They said, your body generates a termination signal. And so I could not use Sprint at all. They couldn't make the system so I could use it.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. Well, this electromagnetism and converting it to sound is, you know, what we do with speakers. That's how the speakers on our phones work, our stereos,
mm-hmm.
our radios.
Mm-hmm.
We're so used to it now, we take it for granted. But, you know, keep in mind, people, this has only been around, for barely 100 years. We have been able to convert electromagnetic energy into sound and broadcast electromagnetic energy from an antenna or from a transmitter to an antenna, pick it up, break it down, decode it digitally or analog, and convert it into sound, either in your car or on your satellite television. It's recent, but the human body is immersed in these frequencies. Now, high frequencies have gotten all the press, certainly have, but the low frequencies, sensitives like Charlotte are picking them up and are having physiological symptoms because of that, and she has learned to interpret the switch and is relaying that information to us. So as you go back and listen to this archive again and again, search your own soul, your own heart, your own life experience, and see if you have this ability as well. And if you do, what we want you to do is to contact Charlotte at Sharking, S-H-A-R-K-I-N-G, at Pfizer. C-H-A-R-K-I-N-G, right?
Uh-huh.
Sharking.
Uh-huh.
Pfizer.net, V-I-S-E-R.net. And share your experience with her and get in her email database. So perhaps you can synchronize your feelings, your sensitivities, and learn about them. I think that's what you want to accomplish, isn't it?
Yes. I like feedback. I like questions. I like input. And I like observations. So any of the above. And if you write, let me know where you live, because that gives me an indication. If I feel something's going on in your area, I want to know what you're feeling, too.
Yeah,
and if you need to call me, and I have my cell phone number posted on my emails, people can call me 24/7 if there's an earthquake or if they're very, very ill. And they say, well, won't I wake you up in the middle of the night if I'm sick? And I said, no, because if you're sick, so am I. I'm up.
Yeah, you're already awake.
Exactly. I'm already there.
That's very interesting. As we got about 10 minutes left in this hour, we've talked about whales disorienting. I want to talk a little bit about this arm wrestling match between the global warming people and the global cooling people, and perhaps get your ideas and your feelings, because certainly major climatic changes on the Earth relative to the mean temperature in a region. Namely, the coming, and I believe it, at least my personal belief, is that ice ages do not come slowly, they come suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
Are we headed for the conditions under which a sudden ice age could occur?
Like in the 16th century. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Also, if it's okay, I would like to also bring to your listeners' attention several different phenomena that I have tied into biological sensitivity. One of them is seismic flu. One of them is the Chile connection. And I'd also like to explore, if you have time, about man-made earthquakes, not natural ones.
Oh, yeah. Well, I definitely want to talk about that. In fact, we have 10 minutes. Let's jump into that right now.
Okay.
Man-made earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that we connected with one another, Earth Explorers, is because of the documentary Holes in Heaven. And that was specifically about the Navy's weapon system known as HAARP. And in the documentary, we made the correlation between use of HAARP and the possible triggering of earthquakes. So let's talk about man-made earthquakes and sound.
Okay, well, all I can tell you from my own personal experience is that I have found a trigger that I watch for, and when this event shows up, and it does on a regular basis, it seems like, you can always expect a quake 7 or greater within 5 to 7 days, usually 1 to 3 days. And there is people in other areas, different websites. One of them is called ELFRAD, and persons have passed away that have been working on this, but there is a man-made signal that has been recorded on numerous occasions up to 8 hours prior to all of these quakes over 7.0. And all of these quakes hit at 10 kilometers deep, the precursor quakes. At 10 kilometers. And I don't know exactly how they're doing it. I don't know if it's HAARP, if it's something they beam up and it beams back down, or if it's some form of space idea that they use to generate a signal to the Earth. But they create the precursor event. And then I believe in some way they harness that energy and create the quake where they want it to happen.
Well, here's something interesting I can add to that. About 4 months ago, a very, very peculiar pattern of earthquakes in Reno, Nevada.
Oh, yeah.
Seismologists began recording aftershocks but the quake had not happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
The aftershocks happened for 3 weeks prior to the quake, sort
mm-hmm.
of like building up to the big quake. It's
the
never happened
event.
Before.
Mm-hmm. Foreshocks.
Seismologists were really, really amazed, and it's still being studied. They don't
mm-hmm.
know what was causing the aftershocks, and they are actually now calling them pre-shocks.
Foreshocks, uh-huh.
For the earthquake. So perhaps
mm-hmm.
you're right. They are testing a new geological weapon. That
if you look at some of the radar pictures, you can see circles or bands that are overlapping each other that are situated right there in that part of Nevada. There are just dozens of circles where these have been hitting, and these are radar, and you could see that they're like circles or donuts of energy all over that area. It's almost like it has to be man-made because there's nothing else that would create that pattern.
You mean like weather radar?
Kind of like weather radar, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're actually picking up concentric circles on the weather radar, on, say, the weather channel, that has its epicenter around where these earthquakes are occurring?
I've seen them. I've seen the pictures that were sent to me. I'd have to find them and send you that site. But, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Mm-hmm.
Holy moly. Now, that is something very, very strange and very frightening. You know, in 1996, Secretary of State Cohen, who was President Clinton's Secretary of State, signed a treaty
mm-hmm.
agreeing not to use weather as a weapon.
Weather manipulation, uh-huh.
Yeah, banning weather warfare.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, this is 1950s paranoia, most people say, but not
mm-hmm.
true. The Secretary
no.
of State does not sign treaties every day, especially
no.
one agreeing not to use a weapon system that probably is quite capable of causing, or at least rerouting, or at least modifying weather.
The jet stream and so on, uh-huh.
Sure, sure, and that's what HAARP is all about. I mean, that's what it does. That's
mm-hmm.
what it does best.
Mm-hmm.
The History Channel, I can't give you any more information, but the History Channel is about to release a new piece of information relative to HAARP that is just going to be earth-shattering.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you more details on that as I am allowed to. But now, you mentioned that someone, or perhaps you'd heard of someone that had lost their lives relative to this. Do you think that
yes.
this information is, you know, someone is out
I believe
this
I believe that
up?
This person was targeted because of his information, because of what he had learned. We've been in contact for several years back and forth, and I would call him and say, okay, now watch for another one, and he would contact me and say, yep, here it is, here's a signal. And we know it was man-made. This guy was an electrical genius, and there was no doubt on the signal being a man-made signal. And it doesn't have the precursor events that a regular earthquake does. So you're kind of caught unaware that there's going to be a major event, except that I've learned now, because I could see the precursor event, to keep an eye out and go on high alert and pay attention to everything that's happening everywhere. Even a small event can be a precursor if it's in the right location. And
well,
they've got one particular area that they seem to be hitting, and that so far, unless they figure it out and that we know where it's at and change it, that's where that makes it a lot easier to tell when they're going to have one.
So you mean that they are targeting the same area over and over again, or there is the same origin?
They're using the same area over and over again to, I guess for lack of another word, because I'm not a scientist, I'm a layperson here, to harness the energy they need to create the earthquake. They create a precursor event. They use that energy some form and focus it like a parabolic or something and focus it where they want the earthquake to hit.
Well, that's the way HAARP works. It is actually designed as an ionospheric heater.
Mm-hmm.
Those of you that know a little bit about AM radio know that Marconi was, at least in namesake, the one that figured out that the ionosphere has an effect on how far an AM signal will bounce. Well, mm-hmm. the ionosphere doesn't cooperate all the time, and we use AM, amplitude modulated signals, to send mm-hmm. ELF messages to naval submarines.
Right.
So wouldn't it be neat if we could shape the ionosphere into a parabolic mirror, sort of like a satellite dish, and thus be able to aim our AM ELF signals to our submarines? And that's exactly what they do with HARP. They use a billion watts with a phased array to push the ionosphere out into space as a giant parabolic mirror, and then they bounce their ELF waves off of that to specific locations. Now, it would be fine if they're just communicating with submarines, but it has been found now, and we have now another piece of evidence with Charlotte, that these ELF waves have other effects. And the effects, apparently, are not being ignored. They're
no.
being harnessed.
Yeah, they're being harnessed, and they're not esoteric.
Right, not esoteric.
One of the earliest experiences I had with HARP, and I didn't know at the time that's what it was during the original Gulf War, Desert Shield. And I started having these mental days, I called them my stupid days, where I would call a cat the dog, I would call a broom a mop, and if my husband say, well, you know, I tell him go get my purse, and it would be on the stove. And he said, well, where is it? And I said, it's on the dishwasher, it's on the refrigerator, it's on the washer, it's on the sink, it's on the stove. And finally I'd get the right word, but it was totally gone. And then I found there were several other people in my area that were also having the same experiences at the same time. And so I contacted some senators at that point and asked them what they were doing over there. And they said, oh, nothing's happening, there's nothing going on. But I know for a fact that every time that happened, we would have a major announcement of some military significance within about 2 days. And I know that they were scrambling something, and mostly it was our brains.
Quite possible. Quite possible.
And it still goes on today. We still go through those days where all of a sudden I'm calling, you know, I say the same, I'm calling a word totally out of context of something I'm looking at, and I call it something else. And that happens more frequently than I like to admit. And I don't think it's old age.
My good friend Nick Begich is an expert at researching these frequencies and their effects on the right and left hemispheres of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And has documented that literally a fraction of a hertz, a fraction of a cycle per second, difference between the right and left half of the brain will actually entrain the brain
mm-hmm.
to have several different responses, insomnia, anxiety, even visions, and even hear things, like hear voices that
mm-hmm.
are transmitted via these ELF waves. It's if you really want to know more about it, you can read his books, and of course he's been on the program a couple of times, so you can go to those archives and look up that stuff. But Charlotte is exactly right. These frequencies have effects on biological systems, and relative to Desert Shield and also the Second Gulf War, these weapons were employed. I know this because I've spoken to military personnel directly who have used these weapons in the field to cause what they call non-lethal effects. But this is, you know, a violation of the sovereignty of the human mind.
Oh,
and,
yeah, it's a violation of a lot of things. But they, you know, they, I remember many years ago, I believe it was President Reagan at the time, he came out of a meeting, and I don't know how he did this without the newsmen around him talking, but he came out and he said, he was talking about Star Wars, and he said, we really need this program, he said, to protect the Earth from objects that are targeted toward the Earth. And I thought that was a very interesting way to put it.
Yeah,
targeted toward the Earth.
Mm. Interesting way to end the second hour of X Squared Radio, December 28th, last program of 2008. My guest is Charlotte King. We will be back. I'm going to play Portland Philharmonic Girls Choir singing a song about the loss of the ancient city of Atlantis. So sit back, relax, about 3 minutes, and we'll be back with more of X Squared Radio.
Thank you.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. December 28th, you just listened to Ancient City by the Portland Philharmonic Girls Choir. By the way, that lead singer was 12 and played the violin along with that. Archaeologists in China are baffled after finding a tiny Swiss watch in a 400-year-old tomb. The watch ring was discovered as archaeologists were making a documentary with two journalists from Shaanxi town. Quote, when we tried to remove the soil wrapped around the coffin, a piece of rock suddenly dropped off and hit the ground with a metallic sound, said Jiang Yangyu, former curator of the Guangxi Autonomous Region Museum. He says, we picked up the object and found it was a ring. After removing the covering soil and examining it further, we were shocked to see it was a watch. The time was stopped at 10.06 a.m., and on the back was engraved the word Swiss, reports the People's Daily. Local experts say they are confused, as they believe the tomb has been undisturbed since it was created during the Ming Dynasty 400 years ago. They have suspended the dig and are waiting for experts to arrive from Beijing and help them unravel the mystery. Quite curious, indeed. Someone might have been time-traveling. Swiss watch found in a 400-year-old tomb. Very interesting. Before we go any further, I want to let you know the phone lines are open, and welcome back, Charlotte, to hour
Thank you very
three
much.
Of X Squared Radio. We have a caller on the line. Your first name and where you're calling from, please.
My name is Denise, and I'm calling from Japan.
Oh, wow. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'll finally get through to both of you. Both are happy. Holidays, and I am getting a little bit of feed on my phone, so I apologize as I'm a little confused when I'm doing this talking right now, but I have a number of questions for Charlotte.
Please, go.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I want to know, first of all, about you've ever been checked for magnetite body? And what your diet has been, and also, have you ever had any UFO contacts that might have triggered this?
Okay. Magnetite, they were doing testing with different parts of various machinery with me at the hyperbaric decompression chambers in Seattle. They used ultrasound equipment and other things to run tests on me for that. And that was... That didn't show anything significant at that time, back in 1980, 79, 80.
What about your diet?
My diet is basic. I'm not vegetarian. I try to eat healthy. I eat a lot of salads. I'm not big into potatoes unless it's French fries and or baked potato. And I like meat, but I can live without it if I had to. I like chicken. I don't eat fish anymore. Very, very seldom eat fish. I guess that's it as far as diet goes. I'm milk sensitive. That started about 5 years ago.
Oh.
Now, what about Denise's final question there? Have you ever had a UFO event, and has that been correlated with your abilities?
Okay, before I answer that, I'm going to backtrack a second. I'm going to say that there are so many sensitives in the world. If there is any correlation, I'm sure that it would not be that, because obviously not every sensitive has had experiences. Yes, I've had multiple experiences. Started in 1949 here in Salem with my parents and my brother, where we had 3 hours of missing time. And my mother still has marks on her body. She's 84 years old and still remembers seeing the ship. I've had experiences where I actually had a circle burned in my backyard in 1991. and missing time where I was out driving around calling people at 2 in the morning and telling them I was following a UFO and I have no memory of it, yet my car had been driven. Yeah, I've had experiences. I've had to have medical attention a couple times after events like that.
Have you ever been hypnotized?
No. They tried to hypnotize me once and it didn't work.
One more question I have for you. Do you have any feeling during the 911 that it might have been a frequency that was directed towards the towers?
You know, I thought about that a lot. I felt it the day before it was going to happen. I told people I didn't know what it was. I just knew there was going to be thousands of people die within 24 hours, and I was sobbing when I went to my boss's office, and she sent me home. And as far as the frequency, I don't know. I do know when different buildings came down, not the two towers, but number 7, I thought about Tesla's ability to bring down machinery or not machinery, but buildings or steel buildings or whatever with sound, and I thought about that at the time. But no, I don't know that there was or had never really thought about the fact that they may have used that in that particular terrorist attack.
One more question. I'm sorry. I have so many. I know I don't want to monopolize the show here. I'm calling from Tokyo, Japan. I was wondering if you had any feelings about anything that might be happening in this area.
Okay, Japan is left shoulder blade pain to the point that it feels like you've wrenched your back. And whenever that picks up intensity-wise, which it has been, again, the last 24 hours or so, I would say you're building for another quake, probably off of eastern Honshu. That would be my guess. And I don't think it's going to be a major event, but it will be felt.
Thank you so much for all of the answers. I appreciate it.
And please email me. Feel free, okay? Email me.
Yes, I will. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Denise, for the call. I mean, it's just amazing that you're listening live there in Japan. It's wonderful.
Yes, through this computer, I'm listening, and it's been a fascinating show. I've just been riveted. I hope that if you have anything that you can remember from that UFO account and to share with the listeners, I'm sure everybody would be fascinated to hear that too.
Okay, thank you.
God bless and take care, everybody.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful new year.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You know, Charlotte, every once in a while, this program gets into this area of encounters, of relationships, actually, with off-world beings. And we hesitate calling them aliens because, after all, I guess we're the aliens, too.
I think we are them.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I don't have judgment one way or the other. I'm a scientist, and I'm an Earth explorer, and maybe beyond. And we don't poke fun at it. We're totally open-minded to it. I have seen UFOs myself. I don't think that I've had. I've only had one missing time event, and, gosh, I was 9 when that happened, and maybe some things have happened since then. I don't know. But I am aware that there are other intelligences in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who can intelligently stand up and say, we are alone in the universe, I am sure has no confidence in his words, because
absolutely,
nothing could be further from truth. But if you want to share those experiences, and you said that you first had a physiological correlation with cataclysmic events in 1976, but then you said in 1949 you had this this UFO event with 3 hours of missing time.
I was 2.5 years old. I have no memory of it. Although I will tell you that at that time, I used from that, I don't know if it was specifically at that time. It may have been before. It may have been after. I'm not sure there's a correlation, but I'll be honest with you about it. There was a point in time where my aunt would tell my mother that she thought, quote-unquote, I was empty upstairs because I would be holding my toy or a toy, and I would turn my head and listen, and they couldn't hear anything. And I would scream if water ran down the drain, if the vacuum was running, if the train, the steam train was going through town, anything that was vibrational or low frequency. I would cover my ears and scream. And about the age of 3, I guess, from what I understand, that just went away until 1976.
Now, at what age do you think you actually became, you know, aware? You actually,
well, I'm thinking that maybe someone told me at one point in time, and I don't know who it was, and I don't recall the exact specifics of it, but something about the sun reversing itself every 30 years. Well, if I was born in 46, maybe I was sensitive, and it took 3 years for that to go away. And then it came back again in 1976 when I was 30 years old. So maybe things will ease off, you know, a little bit now after 3 more years of this.
Well,
I don't know.
No, we know that, and it's quite predictable, that the sun reverses its polarity right at the solar maximum. And if
yeah, 11-year cycles,
is correct.
This was a 30-year cycle.
Right, right. But if you go backwards from 2012, you end up at 1952, which would make you 2.5 to 3 years old.
Well, that's
the
true.
The time of the solar polar reversal.
That's true. You're right. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the fact that, well, I'll put it this way. The observation that we think we just run around on the surface of this planet, have a single lifetime of bounty or rejection or oppression or whatever, and that's all there is to the human soul, is quickly losing ground. That's,
oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, the age-old, and let's just call it Judeo-Christian viewpoint of the human soul, is has lost so much merit in the last 5 years, and more so than at any other time, even during the Middle Ages or Dark Ages, that there's an awakening going on in the world, and unfortunately the vast majority of the population of the earth is asleep, but there are a few of us who are awake and of course live in a constant state of amazement, or in your case a constant state of pain, because you are aware of these frequencies that are that are now bathing the earth and popping up in geographic locations which you have now associated with locations or at least symptoms in your body, which is a remarkable correlation.
Mm-hmm.
And we're so happy to have it on the program, at least have it in the archives for people to refer to and for you to send people to, because, as you say, there are probably hundreds of thousands of people out there that are waking up with a mysterious lower backache or a mysterious right side brain headache or a migraine that won't go away, and they don't know why. And they try to inebriate it with drugs or alcohol or therapies of one kind or another.
Mm-mm.
And what they're actually doing is they're listening to the earth. They're listening to the universe.
One of the things that people that are sensitive tend to do before a big event, and you may or may not notice you're doing it, is people will crave popcorn or corn products. And so you all of a sudden you find yourself getting up middle of the night and wanting popcorn or corn chips or nachos or whatever. Some people just get up and open a can of corn and eat it right out of the can. I've done that myself. And I think, oh, must be another big earthquake coming, you know. And there are days I go to work and there's popcorn being popped at 6:30 in the morning when I get there. And before the Loma Prieta quake in California and before the Northridge earthquake in California, the movie rental places in Salem, like Blockbuster and so on, those were sold out of all microwave popcorn, as was Safeway.
Well, here's something interesting. I have very few kitchen appliances on my kitchen counter. Usually things are put away and neat. One sits out all the time, and
popcorn.
That's the popcorn popper.
And
I do, and have very recently, had cravings for popcorn, and that is quite amazing.
Well, see, corn has choline, and choline is a B vitamin, and the brain requires choline for clear thinking. And so you automatically gravitate toward popcorn because it's the easiest form of corn, most enjoyable.
Nice. I like it. Another reason to get up in the middle of the night and pop a grocery bag of popcorn.
Yeah, right.
I don't really like microwave popcorn because it's so pasty with
water. It is very pasty. You put butter on it and it just sort of melts. It's not any good. But it's hard to...
I like, you know, fresh oil, fresh corn, pop it and eat it hot.
Yeah, I do too. But unfortunately, with these glass-top stoves, you can't shake a popcorn kettle on it very well.
No, that's why you buy a popcorn popper with a stirrer inside of it. I am a connoisseur.
Oh, that kind. Never had one of those.
All right, one more event. We're going to cover this in 40 minutes, and that is
okay. This
time in precession. The Earth is getting ready to go through the galactic plane.
Mm-hmm.
Most cosmologists, and I just met with the head of the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory in Hanford, Washington. Fantastic facility. If you get a chance, you're anywhere close to that. Make a trip up there. They'll give you a tour.
It's too close to St. Helens. I can't get there.
Well, it is a fascinating facility, and they like it because it's so seismically quiet. Aha.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a very, very sensitive Michelson-Morley interferometer, and they actually listen to the universe in search of a black hole. And there's a couple of remarkable things. They realize that in the center of every galaxy may be what they call a supermassive spinning black hole. It
mm-hmm.
may be the light engine that lights up galaxies themselves. So the fact that the Earth is getting ready to go through a very thin band of very intense gravity called the
mm-hmm.
galactic plane, and we're getting ready to do that in exactly 4 years,
mm-hmm.
it is not going to be a night and day, light switch on, light switch off event. It is going to be building up between now and then it is going
mm-hmm.
to be tailing off for a period after that.
Mm-hmm.
Beings like Charlotte may be tied into this very unique set of frequencies that are laid into this galactic plane. What feelings, what thoughts, what ideas do you have on what is in store for the Earth as we go through this galactic plane?
Well, I don't know. My best guess would be we're going to become more and more seismically and volcanically active up to this next 4 years. I think that as the magnetic field changes, it's going to affect the Earth more and more. Things that are deeper, the infrared that heats up underneath, like the solar flares that we used to get, they actually... Every time we'd have solar flares, the activity would pick up in California in the Sierras and the geysers because that solar radiation was heating the geothermal activity underneath the rock and creating more and more earthquakes. And so I think that is a continuation, an ongoing thing as more and more activity ensues with the sun and other things that come into play, including changing the magnetic field with this galactic plane you're speaking of.
Do you have a geographical region of the Earth that you feel might be more safe than another?
Well, I was told one time in a reading from someone that although people that stayed where I am wouldn't all necessarily die, it was imperative that I move away from both oceans. And that would happen sometime in my lifetime that I would know it was time to go. And I would settle either in the Dakotas, Iowa, or Nebraska. None of the places I really want to be. So that's what I was told. But that was from a psychic. That has nothing to do with me. But that's the only areas that I know of. If it's safe for me, it would probably be safe area.
Happens to coincide with the U.S. government placing their most sensitive defense positions in those states as well, because they're as far as possible from the ocean. Interesting sociological fact, 80% of the population of the United States lives within 30 miles of a coast, and that includes major rivers, but
mm-hmm.
that is interesting. If the eastern seaboard or the west coast were to have a tsunami or a debilitating seismic event, it would have a major effect on the Christmas sales for 2009. Let's put it that way.
Yes, it definitely would do that. I think that this galactic plane you speak of, I think that there's been other words used to describe it, such as the photon belt and other things that people talk about, that we're going to have some kind of a change in 2012, whether it be going through a wormhole, and some people say coming out in a different galaxy, some people saying there will be two suns. I don't sense anything like that happening, but there's a lot of theory out there about what people think is going to happen. And I think it's going to be a great ride. I'm excited.
I am too. If we're aware of that, and ancient civilizations leaving their records in stone and copper, in gold, and in various codexes, then do you think it's possible that races not of this world, perhaps distant races, are aware of this event as well? And do you think they're participating in it in some way?
Absolutely. I definitely believe that we are being monitored on a 24-hour basis. I think that they're very aware. I think they're kind of gathering to watch, so to speak. I don't think they're going to reach down and save us if that's what it takes. I don't think that's what they're here for. I think that's our own destiny. But I do believe that the whole entire planet, our planet, is going to go through a major change as 2012 approaches.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I'm hoping that they're sort of like the watchful adult that's sort of observing the three-year-old playing with a pair of sharp scissors.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely have the ability in our hands as governments and as armies and as offensive and defensive militaries to harm the Earth in a catastrophic way ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I'm a little amazed that we haven't experienced nuclear war in our lifetime. I remember growing up as a kid, that was very real.
Very real.
We grew up with it. We had drills.
Duck and cover.
Sure, duck and cover. When I entered the military, we learned how to survive nuclear attack. We learned how to purify water. We learned how long we had to stay underground. We learned what the symptoms were of nuclear sickness. And frankly, maybe it might have had a sociological effect on our nation and maybe upon other nations.
Mm-hmm.
And this generation coming up, they don't have those fears. They don't have those drills or perspective. But there's something else looming out there.
I think that our UFO contact, so to speak, although I think they've been here many, many, many hundreds of years, I think that our current wave of UFO activity, which began in the with Roswell and before Roswell, was a direct result of our using the nuclear bomb in Japan and also of Los Alamos and actually creating the bomb. And I think that they didn't like us playing with something that intense in their backyard. And
they came to
see what was going on, and they've been here ever since.
One of the things that we realize in physics, fusion, which was the second bomb that was exploded over Nagasaki, and
mm-hmm.
weapons that are even more sophisticated, tested many, many, many times since then, cannot be achieved without, it turns out, intense gamma radiation, which is generated by, as luck would have it, an atomic explosion. So they have a fission explosion to cause a fusion explosion, and that's
right.
The way it works. Now,
mm-hmm.
we've tried to do it in methods we call cold. for decades.
Mm-hmm.
We've tried to do it with magnetism. We've tried to do it with omega lasers. Never been successful. It's kind of like squishing a balloon in between your fingers. It just kind of oozes out between the fingers, and you don't get uniform compression. But one thing that we now know is that there are dimensional ripples that occur when a nuclear blast goes off. And
mm-hmm.
these dimensional ripples are felt across the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlotte may be exactly right, that these dimensional ripples that we were doing is a little like a bull in a china shop. We're rattling the crystals all over the universe. And watchmen, caretakers, are coming to see what the heck is going on.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully to keep us from doing something really stupid.
Well, we do have testimony from Army officers and Air Force officers who have testified before the world in open interviews that UFOs showed up and disabled Minuteman missiles.
That's true.
Wiped out the computers, stopped them,
mm-hmm.
shut them down. Now, that's an act of war. That is entering our sovereign airspace and messing with our ability to defend ourselves, like you know, like someone would come and knock down a very carefully placed house of cards.
Mm-hmm.
That may be what Reagan was talking about when he was saying it's important that we develop these weapon systems to perhaps, how did you put it, protect us from something outside?
He said to protect us from things that are targeted toward the Earth. He didn't say a UFO. He said things that are targeted, like you might target an asteroid or something to hit us, or you might target something else to hit us, but not something visiting us, but something targeted toward us.
Well, how do you feel about the weaponization of space?
I don't like it. I think we ought to leave it alone. I don't think it belongs there. Being a romantic, I always had this kind of feeling, you know, that maybe in a perfect world that we would get a threat from space and we would all band together and have peace in order to protect the Earth. But that's not going to happen either. I do hope and I do believe that these beings will in some way keep us from destroying ourselves. I really do believe that's going to happen. I think that we have a place in the galactic society, and they're just waiting, maybe 2012, I don't know. Maybe they're waiting for us to be ready and to take our place, and they in order to do that, we have to survive.
I just recalled the movie about the Crystal Skull that was
mm-hmm.
recently out with Harrison Ford, and the Russian lady who was the villain in the movie told the aliens in the movie that she was ready to have it all. She wanted to know it all.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up burning her, incinerating her.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps as a race, we are not ready for that introduction. It's
mm-hmm.
clear that our DNA didn't originate here. There's even if you want to say that evolution does exist or doesn't exist,
mm-hmm.
if you want to say that we naturally select based on environmental conditions, our DNA could not have originated here. Every biologist knows this. Every geneticist
mm-hmm.
knows this. But they also know that there's a whole pile of DNA that they have no idea what it's for. It's very
That's
sophisticated.
True.
It's
mm-hmm.
common with almost all biology here on Earth, but it could not have originated here.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that people are really curious about, and one of the reasons I brought you on the program tonight is because that you're having physiological sympathetic resonance with
mm-hmm.
frequencies that normally go through people without any effect whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
DNA is being switched on by the nearness of the Earth to these unique frequencies in the universe.
I think
that's
true.
It's quite possible yours got turned on before everyone else's, and that's why you're having these reactions to these frequencies that are around
us. Well, if you take that a little bit further, if DNA is being switched on, perhaps each of these frequencies that we are picking up from wherever, the deep space frequencies, for instance, that are coming through periodically, maybe they are changing our frequency, and our frequency is rising, and we have to have our frequencies change in order to survive what's coming.
And if we don't?
And if we don't, you don't survive it. If you don't change your frequency, if you don't raise your vibration, so to for another word, if you don't raise your vibration, then you won't be able to live through the experience, perhaps, of what's changing or what's coming, whether it be 2012 or 2050. You know, there's something changing. There's obviously something changing. And
one might be out there listening, saying, okay, Charlotte, how do I raise my frequency?
You know what? That's a very good question. I don't know. Although I have been told numerous times in recent years, I have been contacted by all kinds of people, psychics and astrologists and so on. But I have gone to several psychic fairs because I enjoy them, and went up to a couple different people for readings, and totally cold, not telling anybody who I really was or anything. Two different people gave me a reading and said that I had chakras opening up that hadn't been opened before, and that I had a triangle over my head they could see, and that my energy was changing. So then I went to get a aura picture done, and you know what? It showed up on the aura picture. The circles that they were talking about, the chakras opening up, those were not the one that had been taken the year before.
Were there three circles above your head, three orbs
yes.
of light?
Yes, there were.
Hmm. And were they gold in color?
No, they were a deep, almost a deep red fuchsia color.
Interesting.
But my throat chakra, which is one they said was changing, was a violet color. And my third eye in the center of the forehead was almost white. And they said it was, showed that it was open.
Now, what was the shape of the whiteness on your third eye?
Kind of oval.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Have you had yourself photographed numerous times?
Three times so far. I haven't done it for about 4 years.
And were the three photographs the same?
They were similar, but they definitely had different pictures and so on. I mean, different objects within the photograph.
How about the
I remember taking a parapsychology class, and when they had the picture done, they used some kind of a coil over our head to take the picture. And everybody else seemed to work great. For me, there was a little beam of electricity. Everybody screamed when it went from the coil into the top of my head. And it made quite an interesting picture. Very electrifying in all ways.
Now, for those of listeners out there who don't know what we're talking about, this is a method of photography that freelancers do from time to time, special film, special camera, often called Curlian photography or aura
photography. Curlian photography, yes.
If you get a chance and you're out there and you see a paranormal convention of some kind, you know, find one of these photographers and have your aura photographed, and then maybe have it done a few times and try to change your mood, change your frequency, as Charlotte would call it, and watch the effects.
Most fascinating things I ever saw in aura or Curlian photography was a gentleman who had lost one of his fingers, and they did the picture of his hand, and the energy was still there from the missing finger, and it had been gone for 2 years.
Well, let me add this to it. I was talking with Dr. Bruce Lipton, who's the author of The Biology of Belief.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, he worked very intensely on the Human Genome Project and was a medical school instructor in the Caribbean. and wrote this fascinating book, and I asked them the question, you know, how does a cell know when it dies and a new cell is going to take its place? For instance, how does it know to become muscle tissue or eye tissue or bone or ligament? How does it know? And he said, well, it just goes by the tissue that's next to it. And I said, okay, well, that raises two questions for me, Bruce. First of all, what if the cell is right at the interface between, say, an eye muscle and eye tissue? Or the second part of the question is, what if you're just starting with two cells, the egg and the sperm? How do they fill in to become the fetus? And he said, I am so glad you asked that question, because what we discovered is there is an electromagnetic template when conception occurs. And what happens is the cells differentiate in three dimensions to fill in the electromagnetic image of the fetus. That was fascinating.
Oh, wow. It's fascinating. That's fantastic.
So when I talk about DNA being activated, and really these questions have come up over numerous interviews, and I've never really had a full answer, but you know, we keep asking, and hopefully different guests with different perspectives like yours can fill in a piece or two. I really haven't had a frequency sensitive one like yourself that can pick up on these frequencies and identify these frequencies, and you've learned to geographically associate these frequencies with seismic events, with perhaps precursors to catastrophic events here on the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to continue your research? How are you going to...
Well, I'm in the process of writing a book. And hopefully it'll be out within 6 months or so, probably, yet, before it goes to press. It's going to be called Earthquake Language, The Charlotte King Effect.
Fascinating.
And what I'm doing now is I'm trying to get more and more people aware of what they're feeling, so each person... through their own body can protect themselves and have that flight or fight syndrome hit. When it hits them, they'll know how to react to it, to learn their own area, what that area would feel like, so they will have that sense of safety that they need to have. And the more people I make contact with in different areas, the more opportunity there is to link people together so they can, if they're interested, so they can stay in touch with each other and form their own little networks out there of seismic sensitives. I have a pamphlet that I sell. It's not anything really fancy. It's pretty basic. It's $25, and I pay shipping. And it explains several of the larger events and what led up to those events, not only for myself but other people, and all the areas and symptoms of the areas, background information. It goes into the Chile connection, which is something I would like to touch on very briefly, if I might.
Sure, let's go.
Well, the Chile connection is a symptom that started out with fear, panic, anger, rage, pacing, didn't know what it was. This happened in 1979. I was in my garage at home, and I went in the house, and I was, you know, wanted to bang my fist against the wall and didn't know what was happening. Well, the next day, the newspaper carried a story of a young boy in junior high here in Salem that had gone into the garage, perfectly healthy young man, school, everything happy, taken a circular saw, put it on his neck, and turned it on. That is the Chile connection. The Chile connection is when things happen spur of the moment, whether it be murder, suicide, terrorist attack, shootings, stabbings, road rage, overreaction to normal events, and as again, spur of the moment, like with someone when they went into Columbine, that was a pre-thought thing. That wasn't a spur-of-the-moment event. But the one in Oregon was a spur-of-the-moment event and was followed by an earthquake. And these earthquakes take place within 12 to 72 hours after the fact. They are Chile, Bolivia, or Argentina, and they always, always happen. And we have found numerous occasions now where people, especially people that are bipolar or manic depressive, are very, very affected by Chile events, and in most cases have to have extra medication during that time. I've heard from a lot of clinical people that have contacted me about that. And suicides go rampant prior to events in Chile. I had a friend in California who knew all about this stuff. She was a sensitive, very nice lady. Before one of the large events, she went upstairs and she shot and killed her husband, then she shot and killed herself with her children downstairs. And the next day we had a major event in Chile. A few years ago, a girlfriend of mine who I spoke to every day on the phone, we laughed and joked, and she was sensitive, and we were chatting away for 2 hours, and finally I said, well, I better go fix dinner. And she said, yeah, my husband's due home in a few minutes. I've got to fix dinner, and I'll see you tomorrow. And I said, okay. 5 minutes later, she was dead with a gunshot. And
wow.
I didn't even sense it. This does really, really affect people. It makes things that are normally just miserable unbearable. And we have had in Oregon here, especially the 3 or 4 mile section of train track in Salem, 35 people have died on our train tracks here. And I was part of the governor's task force called Project Lifesaver, trying to figure out why these people were dying. Some of them would be laying on the tracks waiting for the tracks. Other ones would be walking down the tracks, see the train coming, turn around, and just keep right on walking. And it was obvious it was intentional. And every single one of those events, except one where an 80-year-old lady slipped and fell on the tracks, every one of them was followed within 72 hours by a quake in Chile, Bolivia, or Argentina.
Absolutely fascinating. Charlotte, do you think the Earth has been here before? Do you think races, ancient civilizations perhaps have been at this precipice before?
I thought a lot about that. Have we advanced to this point in time before and then everything went away? I don't know. Sometimes I think it has, because I think, how can we have gone this far? How can we have done this? They must have had something to look at, something to go back on. But then other times I look at it and I say, you know, if we've come this far, then some of the things we're doing, we really should be ashamed of ourselves. How can we even expect to go any further if we don't take better care of our planet? And I think that history, especially when you get into things like the crystal skulls, is so far beyond anything I can imagine. Where these came from, where they had the technology to do that. How did they build the pyramids and make them even better than our best scientists can still put together today? Yeah, it makes one wonder. I don't know. I really don't know.
It is fascinating, and the abilities that you have, that you've been brave enough to come out with, to explain to us, to share with us this evening. I for one, am grateful, and I'm sure that the listeners all over the world, as they tune in on Monday morning, heading back after their holiday vacations, will enjoy learning about your experiences as well. We have your email address. We now know you have a pamphlet for sale, which is probably most definitely informative, and we encourage people to help Charlotte out. Go to contact her by email and make arrangements to pick that up. I'm fascinated by the entire subject tonight. I, you know, realize that it was a spur-of-the-moment interview. I told you we'd have an amazing experience tonight, and frankly, it's been an awesome interview. I hope that you have felt the same way.
if you have about 2 minutes, I'll go through some of the locations and symptoms people might feel.
You bet. We have about 7 minutes left. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, the Northern California is upper back pain. And that pain is sometimes associated with elbow pain as well. And if you're very, very sleepy, then it goes to San Jose, Morgan Hill, Santa Cruz, California, the Loma Prieta area. If it's temple-to-temple pain with achy earaches, then it's San Jose, Eureka to the Bay or the Bay proper. If you get into Southern California, the pain is in the center of the forehead and bands around the head, and you get sharp heart pain, like little jabs in the heart. But if you go into Palm Springs, Whittier, or Pasadena, then the heart pain also is joined with earaches, as it is in Italy, Sicily, Greece, and Crete. But if you have a quake in Italy, Sicily, Greece, or Crete, especially Greece or Crete, then you also get achy chest and elbow pain and moderate to severe migraine, and that goes into Turkey. And Turkey is also prefaced by events in the Aegean, the Caspian, or the Ionian Sea. And then you get into the areas like Washington State, which is always back of head pain on the left side and sharp heart pain. Before events in Washington, there's always a wave of vertigo that hits 4 days before the quake. Washington State is always 4 days. Every place else is 3 days. Volcanic events are always back ahead, left side. Chile is left eye and left side headache. The Kuril Islands is the right shoulder blades. The Japan is the left shoulder blade. The full upper back is Indonesia. If you get pain in the right ribs, I've coined them the Domino Islands because these islands tend to mash together one event after another, like dominoes. And that would be Tonga, Fiji, Samoa, Marianas, Vanuatu, Loyalty, Admiralty, Solomons, Carolines, those islands. Then you go to the left rib pain and you get into Australia, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, and the Kermadec Islands. And right earache is Taiwan, leeward, windward, Trinidad. Left earache is China, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nicobar Islands of India. And there's heart pain with headaches that goes with the volcanoes in Hawaii. The Cascade volcanoes are always left side back ahead, whereas the ones like Pinatubo was right side front of head. The different, like the seismic flu areas, which is Idaho, Utah, Montana, Wyoming, West Yellowstone, that's intense low back pain that's followed with intestinal or stomach flu symptoms. But if you go into the New Madrid, which can involve 16 different states, it's almost always stomach flu symptoms with the low back pain and teeth chattering chills that happen before that event. And there's so many more other ones. I mean, they're just, you know, I'm just running off some of them that I have down on the top of my head. But one of the things I found most interesting here, and I've been watching for many years, is ant invasions. Ants will always invade before a major earthquake. And they will come out like, you know, thousands of them even. And then they'll disappear in 3 days like they've never been around. I mean, they'll just disappear. Sometimes it's longer than 3 days, but mostly it's 3 days. And some of the interesting things I've experienced with the ants is they'll come in and out of the wall sockets. They will gravitate toward the microwave, the freezer, the coffee pot, the toaster, anything the 60 cycle, anything they can get away from the low frequency they're picking up from the earth. And then all of a sudden they'll just be gone. It's so funny because one of the locations I lived, we had so many of them come out, and they would be sitting around in little circles, you know, like a little sewing circle, sitting there waiting. And all of a sudden they apparently get this frequency that they feel, okay, it's safe to go back into our nest. And what that is actually is the calm before the storm, and they go back in their nest, and within 12 to 24 hours, the quake hits. And I won't kill ants because they're the best precursor you can have. Real quick event in point was the Northridge earthquake. I had a friend in California there that was very aware of what was going on and a sensitive, and I told her to watch for the ants because I knew they had happened with landers. And so she called me, and she worked at the North Bank on the second floor, concrete building. And she said, Charlotte, you won't believe the ants. And I said, how many? And she said, oh, the entire floor is a carpet. And I says, oh, okay. She said, what should I do? And I said, well, you don't want them to kill all of them because they had called the exterminators. So I said, get some of them out. So she went in her office, opened up a sandwich, threw it on a paper plate on the floor, and let about 100 of them in the room. And then she blocked the room so that nothing would hurt them. And she left the room and put stuff around the floor so nothing could get in. And the ants, of course, unfortunately, were killed. But she went back to her office later that day, and I said, are the ants still there? And she said, yes. And then she called me about an hour later. She said, they're gone. I said, okay, 24 hours or less. So I put my call in to Caltech about 5 hours later and told them 12 hours or less, and the quake hit about 5 hours later.
How about that?
But the ants knew, and they feel that vibration. And I have a map that someone sent me from Rockwell, and I don't have a clue who gave it to me. And it's got concentric circles around it on this map, and on each line it tells you what frequency reacts to it. And one of them, it says, ants come out of the ground and align their antenna to magnetic north at this frequency.
About that. Fascinating stuff. You mind emailing me a copy of that map? I'd love to see it.
If I can, if I could get it on anything, it's 4 by 5 feet. It's a big map. So.
Well, just take a photograph of it.
If I could take a photograph of it, I will, because I don't know where it came from. I just know, and it actually, believe it or not, had a deal about, had a little script on there of about alien contact on it, about the reaction to that frequency.
How about that? I could do another hour on this, Charlotte, but we're out of time.
Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much. I enjoyed it very much, and I hope to hear from some of your listeners.
Yes, yes, absolutely. My pleasure. My guest tonight has been Charlotte King, the Charlotte King Effect. Her email address is sharking@visor.net. That's visor.net. Charlotte, it's been my pleasure.
And, thank you.
We will be back in contact with you another time. And believe me,
thank you so much.
If you come
please
up
do.
With a prediction or a forecast, as you call it, please get a hold of me. You've got my phone number. You've got my email address. Let us know, and we'll put you on the air right away.
Okay, I appreciate that. One area of just real quickly that you might want to pay attention to is your Yellowstone area, because I think it's building for another larger event. Lots of low back pain being reported.
Okay, well, I have one right now, as a matter of fact. I'll put that on the website. We'll make people aware. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much.
We'll talk to you another time.
Mm-hmm, you bet. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. All right, Earth Explorers, December 28th. 2008, last show of the year. It was great. We'll see you another time. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.